Like, you know, I mean, this is definitely one of those moments, and like, I hate admitting this kind of thing, but like, where I'm kind of like chuckling as I'm writing, and I like finished writing the scene and I handed the computer to my wife. I was like, read this. And she read it and she's like, that's nice, honey. So, she's good for keeping me humbled. This is Ian Desher, the author of the William Shakespeare Star Wars series, and you are listening to Star Wars Ties.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to an exciting special episode of Star Wars Ties. I am so excited to share with you guys that we are going to be doing an interview with Ian Desher, the author of the William Shakespeare Star Wars series, and I have with me none other than the English teaching masterful co-host himself, Mr. Rob Vader. How you doing, Rob?
Oh man, what an introduction. I feel so special.
Well, I mean, you are special. I'm not going to clarify which kind is special.
Oh, man, I'm doing well, buddy. You've been doing okay?
I've been doing really good. This has been, I mean, I'm so excited. This is going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, anytime we get a chance to interview somebody, it's just something I'm really excited about doing. And I see him, you know, he just sent me a message. So let's go ahead and welcome him, and then we'll jump right into it.
I'm here.
Hello. It's nice to meet you. I'm Jameson.
Yeah, you too.
Hey, Ian. I'm Rob.
Hey, Rob.
There we go.
Very good to talk to you, and I'm so sorry it's so early.
Oh, that's all right. I'm usually up by now.
Well, you sound like us. We have little ones, so, Lord, it's about the only time we can get
anything done. It's about the only time we can get anything done is if we do it early in the morning.
Exactly. Yep.
As I'm sipping my coffee here. Well, we're very excited to get the chance to interview you and talk to you. I've been reading the Shakespearean Star Wars books for probably about 6 months now, and I'm loving them. I think they're awesome.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
And Rob over there is my co-host, one of my co-hosts for Star Wars Ties, and he is our resident English teacher, so I figured I'd definitely bring him in with this one.
By far no expert, though. Lord, I don't know what I'm doing. But yeah, it's so cool. As I was reading through this, and I'm sure we'll kind of mention it as we record, but oh, there's so much I could use in the classroom. I said, oh, you know, we're doing a drama unit this year. I'm seriously going to make the pitch to my boss to use this book, the New Hope book.
Yeah.
So as I was reading through it, I was like, oh my gosh, there's so many things I could teach. Iambic pentameter, what asides are, dialogue. Oh, it's going to be fantastic. And then I can brag about the podcast, too. I can throw that in there and be like, oh, by the way.
All right. All right. By the way, I talked to this guy.
I talked to the guy.
Yeah. Which is pretty exciting. I'm just excited anytime I get to talk to somebody who's done something with the actual Star Wars universe. Mm-hmm. And this is, my father was an English teacher. I'm a band director. I didn't quite go into the English direction, but it's just exciting to be able to read something that has such an interesting connection and blend of two different genres. So my first question would be, what inspired the idea to develop Star Wars specifically into a Shakespearean style play?
So three things happened right around the same time, and this was about 7 years ago. I watched the Star Wars trilogy with some friends of mine from high school. I hadn't seen the movies in a few years, and of course I knew them really well, but it was sort of a revisiting, rediscovery of them, I would say. And not too long after that, I read Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which is one of the first mashup books that was really popular. And then just after finishing that book, I went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival with my family. And so, and actually we were at the Shakespeare Festival and we saw a really creative modern adaptation of Shakespeare called The Very Merry Wives of Windsor, Iowa. And so I was at that Shakespeare Festival and sort of had Star Wars on my brain, had mashups on my brain, and was thinking about creative things to do with Shakespeare. And that was when I had the idea. I was like, it would be really fun to take Star Wars and rewrite it as though it were a play by Shakespeare. And I had no idea if it would, you know, if that idea would fly. But I looked up Quirk Books online. They're the ones who published Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and they had done other mashups too. And their editor's email address was on their website. So I just sent them an email and said, hey, I have this idea. I'm a random person you've never heard of, but here's my idea. And he wrote me back and he said, that's an interesting idea. And if you write something, let me know and I'll take a look at it. So I put together the first act of the first book. So, you know, the first fifth, basically, and sent that off to him. And he called me up that morning and he was like, okay, I really want to do this. And the next step is getting Lucasfilm on board. And at that point, we were basically off to the races.
Wow,
that's awesome. So what was the process with getting Lucasfilm on board? Was that a difficult process, or was that something that kind of went just as streamlined?
I mean, it was basically just as streamlined, I always tell everybody, like, don't take my story for how it's supposed to go, because it's not usually this easy. But he sent my what I had done off to Lucasfilm, and they very wisely, you know, we all think of Lucasfilm as being very protective of their material, of course. And so I had stayed fairly close to the movie. I had not added a lot of, you know, too much of my own stuff. And right. their feedback was, if we're going to do this concept, basically, like, might as well go all the way with it, right? So they said, we want to see if he can do more with it and have more fun with it. And so they asked me to revise the first couple of scenes. And so that's when I added R2-D2 speaking in English in his asides to the audience, and I added things like stormtroopers talking about getting drinks with Mos Eisley with Darth Vader and stuff like that. And so we sent those scenes back to them, and they were like, okay, we're happy to entertain the licensing contract now. And so so at that point, Quirk Books and Lucasfilm sort of made the licensing deal, which I was mostly not privy to, which is fine by me. And then the book came out with under a year of me having the idea for it, which is pretty fast for publishing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, so, you know, I read in the biography that you have in The New Hope, and it says that you were born 45 days after the movie had come out. So do you somehow consider that almost like fate, that you had to write about Star Wars sometime in your life? Like, where did it all start with your fascination first with Star Wars and then eventually with Shakespeare?
I'm not sure I'd go quite so far as to call it fate, but I definitely grew up with Star Wars. You know, it was my parents are sort of people who, you know, really enjoy science fiction and that kind of thing. And so they always raised us. My brother and I were raised watching the Star Wars movies, and we had Star Wars action figures and everything that a kid of the 80s, you know, tends to have. And we had, you know, the making of a saga, which was the sort of making of Star Wars that they created in the mid 80s. It was mostly about Return of the Jedi and how they did Jabba and all of that kind of stuff. And so I used to watch that all the time and loved that. And so, and then Shakespeare, let me go back and say, I honestly have, like, I can't tell you the moment when I first learned about Star Wars, because it was before I have memories, right? I just grew up with it. Shakespeare, I came to in high school. My freshman year of high school, we read Othello in English class, and I had a great English teacher, and I was also a theater kid. So, you know, we're reading a play in class, and I was the nerd who, when we had to memorize a soliloquy and, like, present it to the class, would, like, do a big dramatic reading of it, you know, and, like, I mean, I was that guy. And so, and Shakespeare was just, you know, it had such rich characters. I mean, in Othello, I've always loved the character of Iago. I just think he's such a terrible villain. I mean, you know, he's such a such a good villain, right? So I was just fascinated by the stories and the characters and the language. And it was that same teacher who, just as we were starting to learn about Shakespeare, taught us about the different poetic feet and meter and all that kind of stuff, which all just made really good intuitive sense to me. You know, I also loved Dr. Seuss growing up, and with Dr. Seuss, you get so much. It's funny. He's actually so strict about meter, and you don't think about it as you're reading it, because he's so natural and it flows so well. And so all that stuff just sort of came together to the point where when I, you know, whatever, 30 some years later, when I told people, hey, I'm going to be doing a book, you know, the combined Star Wars and Shakespeare, most people who knew me really well were like, oh, yeah, of course you are. Like, of course that's what you would do, right?
That sounds like me with a Star Wars podcast.
Yeah.
That is awesome. So you mentioned the Dr. Seuss thing, and I mean, of course, I have two kids, and I constantly am reading Dr. Seuss books. I've never thought about that, but now that you say it, it's so obvious
Yeah, I mean,
how
it's
strict he is to
great.
following that meter.
Yeah, and it's part of what makes his books, sing so well. I mean, you can just rattle off Green Eggs and Ham or The Cat in the Hat, and it just is so perfect. And I just love it. Love it.
Yeah,
Well,
but see,
that reminds
I've
me of
done that very
something.
thing.
Yes. So that reminds me of something. We have a poetry unit right around December every year, and we eventually cover sonnets. And that seems to be the one that most of my students struggle with. I teach 7th grade, and of course we read Sonnet 18. And we talk about it, break it down, what iambic pentameter is, and all these things. So you have literally written thousands of lines in iambic pentameter. Does it just come natural for you? Are there any tricks of the trade that I could possibly pass on to my students?
I mean, what I will say is it gets easier the more you do it. And that's a little hard with students who are doing it for the very first time, right? But these days, it's just so natural, and I really can write iambic pentameter very quickly. And I could, it's just so much easier now than it was when I was starting. And so, yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I've done workshops with kids where I'm helping them try to write some iambic pentameter, and it's I think the challenge is often getting kids to understand, emphases and syllables and things like that, so that they understand where the beats are, instead of just trying to total up 10 syllables in a line. You're actually trying to do this rhythm. And so I think the more you can sort of overemphasize, when you're reading something, to be or not to be, that is the question, right? Like, I think that helps kids a little bit get the idea in their head, like, oh, okay, I see how this is, but I do think it's hard. I think it's just practice makes perfect with iambic pentameter.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to tell them, hey, you guys got to write more.
Yeah, exactly.
They'll love me for
So you mentioned that when Lucasfilm asked you to do a little bit more of your own thing with the writing of the original, you decided to add the R2D2's English asides to the audience. Why did you pick R2D2, and what kind of inspired those particular asides?
So part of that was, okay, Lucasfilm was giving me permission to sort of go above and beyond, so let me go ahead and try something. And then it was this idea of, like, we all sort of have a sense of who R2-D2 is, right? I mean, the movies do such an amazing job with just his beeps and squeaks, right, of getting across this character of a droid who is both noble and snarky, right? And so I just wrote his lines, like, with that in mind, right? Like he's this one who, like, is gonna, sort of want to get at C-3PO for being rude, but at the same time is, like, wanting to help the rebellion succeed, And so it was actually, I mean, even though Lucasfilm had asked me to do more, that particular edition of R2-D2 speaking in English was something that Lucasfilm was a little nervous about, and my editor sort of went to bat for me and said, that he really thought it would work and everything. And so, of course, Lucasfilm let it stand, and that was probably the thing that people liked most about that first book
I know.
was
Definitely one
that
of my
thing.
favorite parts.
I mean, we all, because we all imagine, right? We all imagine what R2-D2 must be thinking right now, right? And so to actually be able to see it give an expression, I think, for all of us who are fans, I think that helps.
Yeah, I agree.
So the process of writing it, I mean, obviously you said it was done within a year from the inception of the idea to it being published. That is incredible. How specifically was the process? Did you literally write down every line and then translate it into iambic pentameter as you did it, or was there another way you did it?
I mean, that's fairly close, right? So basically, I would listen to, okay, here's a line of dialogue, and I would go to the script online if I was unclear about somebody had said, or if I needed to figure out the exact spelling of something. Sometimes I'd go to Wikipedia or something like that, and so I'd figure out okay, here's what the exact line is, and then I would think, okay, how should that go in iambic pentameter? And is there an opportunity here for a character to have an aside, or are they alone on stage? They could have a soliloquy, Luke staring out at the double suns of Tatooine, right? Like Shakespeare's never going to have him just be silent. You know, he's always going to tell you exactly how he's feeling. So it was looking for moments like that. And then later on, as I went on with the books, it was also sort of remembering about various rules that I had come up with for different characters, like Yoda always speaks in haiku, and all of Mace Windu's lines include the title of a Samuel L. Jackson movie, and things like that. So, like, it was just these, you know, these other things, the other sort of challenges that I gave myself as time went on. And so basically when I would sit down to write, you know, I just try to get like 3 or 4 minutes of the movie done every time I sat down to write. And, you know, you do that enough times and eventually you're through the movie.
Wow.
That's awesome. So when you said you base a lot of this off of the actual scripts that you found online and things like that, when you write it, do you hear like Carrie Fisher's voice or Mark Hamill's voice or Samuel L. Jackson's voice in iambic pentameter as you write? Is that kind of how you visualize? I'm just curious. That's how
certainly I try to take on their, I mean, I don't know that I'm hearing their literal voices, but I'm certainly trying to capture the characters, right? You know, like Han Solo should sound different than Obi-Wan Kenobi does, right? In that sense, like, and yeah, so I'm trying to capture those and be true to those characters, especially when I'm writing lines for them that are not in the movies, when I'm writing soliloquies and things like that. Like, hopefully should feel really true to who those characters are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Lucasfilm, I will say also that Lucasfilm is a helpful guide for that, right? They're reading the manuscripts and they are letting me know if they feel like I'm going out of my lane at all, basically, right? So there's one speech of Darth Vader's from the first book, when after Tarkin has decided that he's going to take the Death Star to Alderaan, you know, Darth Vader had this speech where he was basically sort of questioning whether or not killing innocent people was a good thing, right? And to have feeling a little bit of remorse for it. And Lucasfilm's comment about that was like, no, as of episode 4, Darth Vader is not feeling any remorse. He's not, you know, he's not right. going to be sad about this at all. And so I basically turned that speech around 180 degrees. And the line that had been the first line of the soliloquy, which had literally been "the death of innocence brings me no joy," became "the death of innocence doth bring me joy." Right. So, like, but it was just fascinating that they know their characters that well, right? That they are going to make sure that you're not doing anything that shouldn't be done. And there were a couple of times in writing Empire where they felt like I went a little too far in expressing Luke's crush for Leia. Right. Yeah. Or not, maybe not Empire. Maybe that was also A New Hope. I think that was anyway. So, yeah.
Speaking of Empire, you did a couple of things that were different in Empire Strikes Back that you didn't do in Shakespeare, in the original Barely a New Hope. And one of them was allowing like the Wampa and the space slug to both have a voice, which I thought was hilarious. And probably one of my favorite parts of the Empire Strikes Back. And then you also had, I noticed that you did it in Verily a New Hope and in Empire Strikes Back, you had 2 stormtroopers, or I think it was just 2 citizens of Cloud City, just having a little bit of dialogue between each other that broke the fourth wall. And those were great. I absolutely loved that. Because it's you were literally addressing some of the things that probably go through many of our minds as viewers. Like, why do they have these large chasms right beside, you know, walkways? It makes no sense. Because I actually did think that as a kid, especially in like A New Hope and Empire or Return of the Jedi, when you see the Death Star and right in the middle of the landing bay there's this massive gaping hole.
Right Yeah. I mean, that those were, again, as a Star Wars fan and a huge geek, right, like those were definitely the most fun scenes to write. Because and it started, the genesis of it was, you have that scene in A New Hope where the Millennium Falcon gets pulled into the Death Star, and there are these 2 stormtroopers standing guard right outside the Millennium Falcon, and they hear the sounds of a scuffle inside, and they don't do anything. And then you hear Han Solo's voice says, "Hey, can we get some help in here?" And they go up the ramp and they get killed. And like, and I always thought, like, you know, just even as a kid, I thought, like, don't these guys like do they not have any minds of their own that they wouldn't possibly think that something is up here? And so I decided to write this dialogue where one of them has basically figured it out, right? That, like, isn't it possible that there are these Rebel is hiding on board right now, you know, and that this is the ship that went off from Mos Eisley, and like isn't it possible that they're here to like rescue the princess or something, you know? And the other guard basically, you know, calms him down and it's like, hey, we're just simple stormtroopers. Do you really think you know better than Darth Vader and Governor Tarkin? You know, let's calm down and respect our leaders. Wow. And he's like, okay, you're right. And then they get called in by Han Solo and they get killed, right? So like, and like, you know, I mean, this is definitely one of those moments, and like, I hate admitting this kind of thing, but like, where I'm kind of like chuckling as I'm writing, and I like finished writing the scene and I handed the computer to my wife. I was like, read this. And she read it and she's like, that's nice, honey. So, she's good for keeping me humble. But yeah, I decided after that it was going to be a sort of a tradition in these books that every book in Act 4, there's going to be this dialogue between two characters where they're sort of poking fun at the movies in one way or another. And Lucasfilm has never said no. So in fact, I don't think they've ever had, I don't think they've ever even like commented on them to even say like, oh, you shouldn't quite go this far or anything like that. I think that they've always just accepted it, which again is like, I think a tribute to them. And, you know, they know that like these books are meant to be fun and playful and that sort of thing. And so they don't mind that I'm sort of making fun of various things.
I think they're great.
Well, one thing that strikes me, too, with the writing is that it works so well. Now, did you know about the artwork that was going to be featured in these books, or was that something that happened later?
It basically happened later. I mean, they found the artist, and he's just amazing. And basically, they would, you know, sort of send me stuff. For later books, we would always have discussions about who we thought would be best for to have on the cover and that kind of thing.
Oh, wow.
But then they would also ask, you know, are there any specific illustrations that you think we should have based on what your ideas are for writing? So an example of that would be like in the Force Doth Awaken, I gave a speech to the Happobor, which is the big creature that is drinking water alongside Finn in the big water trough on Jakku. and so he's a very like refined and sort of haughty character the Happobor is. And so I, you know, suggested like it might be fun to have an illustration of him where he looks very sort of noble and proper. And so, and then, you know, they'll send me like the drafts of the illustrations and then the final illustrations. And every time I'm just so blown away. I love getting those emails because it's so much fun to see the illustrations come together. And I think they really help you imagine what this mashup looks like, right? And how it could actually work on stage and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's great. I love the artwork. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic. And it does really mesh perfectly with what you've written. You mentioned the play adaptation, and I know that that's not something copyright-wise that's currently available, but are there any particular scenes or moments where if you were looking at it in either the Globe Theater or just a standard stage today, where you would go, that's how I would like to see that scene performed. Whether it be, you know, the explosion of something, even though a lot of that probably has to be left to the imagination, or, you know, scenes where characters would have to go, you know, underneath, like they've dropped through a chute or something. Are there tricks of stage that you've actually considered going, you know, if this were ever put on stage, that would probably be the only way they'd ever be able to make it work?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. When I wrote the first book, I was really not thinking too much about it being staged. And it wasn't until really when that book first came out that we started hearing from theaters who were interested in doing it. And then I started thinking more about how this would actually be staged if you were, you know, if you were using the Elizabethan stage. And so one thing I could imagine, I mean, relating to what you just said, right? One thing I could imagine is the scene where Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker are having their sort of final confrontation. No, well, not final confrontation. Their first confrontation, really. And Darth Vader reveals that he's Luke's dad. You know, you could imagine at that point, because the Elizabethan stages tended to have trapdoors of one kind or another, right? And so you could imagine Luke literally disappearing through the trapdoor as he decides to jump off of the I suppose that scene could happen on the balcony of the Elizabethan stage, and somehow you've got Luke rigged to be able to fall below to the stage. But yeah, it's an interesting question. I haven't actually given that a lot of thought, but I do think that actually staging these any of these would certainly be a massive feat. If you actually tried to like take on a lot of the sort of sci-fi, you could go the the route of just a very bare bones Shakespearean stage, and then a lot of things would be more imagined than seen might also be the way to do it.
Mm. Right. Which is, I mean, that's not a bad way either.
Right.
Just, you mentioned you had an interest in theater. Did you pursue that not only through high school but beyond it, or was that just something you kind of kept within the realms of grade school?
I mean, through high school and into college, I did a lot of theater. I had hoped to be a theater major, but auditioned for it and did not get into it. So that sort of stopped my longer, like, broader theater dreams. But, yeah, so it was mostly through college.
Okay, cool.
So as far as the writing goes, is that something you've always wanted to do? And if so, like, what inspired you to write in the first place?
So, I mean, I guess I would say that certainly since I was young, I was not the sort of kid who was saying, oh, I want to be a writer. But I certainly was writing all the time since I was young. I didn't start reading heavily until after college, actually, which is I think kind of rare. And I associate those two really. I associate the desire to write really strongly with becoming a more avid reader, mm-hmm. because I don't think you can be a good writer and not be somebody who reads a lot. And
exactly.
And so it really was not until I started reading a lot that I started thinking, boy, I would love to do this more. And then I went to graduate school, right? And eventually, like, I thought maybe that I would write academic books, actually, was what I really thought my path was going to be. And so I did, at that point, you know, I was interested in writing books, really wanted to do that, but never thought I would be writing something like these. And of course, this is way more fun than writing academic books.
yes, I bet so.
Yeah, so I guess I would say that kind of since my early mid-20s, I have been interested in actually, like, publishing books.
Wow, that's awesome. In the plays, I noticed that you had several moments that were, I would call them Easter eggs or references to actual Shakespearean plays. So, for example, when Luke Skywalker gets out of the trash compactor, he picks up the Stormtrooper helmet and kind of does the whole, you know, moment where he's talking to a skull, for lack of a better word. And you also had a direct takeoff of Julius Caesar, which I had to look up, I'll be honest, with the lend me your ears kind of speech. What are some other Easter eggs or Shakespearean specific elements that you directly just put into the plays?
Yeah, I tried to do that as often as I could without being kind of too painfully obvious. And sometimes it still is too painfully obvious, if I'm honest. But like when the original first line of Luke's soliloquy when he's looking out at the two sons of Tatooine was, to go or not to go, that is the question. And I thought that was maybe just a little too much. But I do try to, you know, I'm trying to use these references throughout, again, to sort of help with the Shakespeare side of the mashup, and also, you know, with that hope that these books might be a way to help get kids interested in Shakespeare, you know, like, read these books and already realize that there are some lines of Shakespeare dropped in there, I think is right. It was on my mind as well. And so the way I choose those references, I mean, generally speaking, probably 75% of the time, it's just that there's something going on in the scene where it makes me think of a moment in Shakespeare. And so I think, oh yeah, let's use this line from over here because this is feeling thematically similar. So like Luke getting up to speak to all of the rebels and it feels a little like Mark Antony getting up in front of the Romans and saying, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Right. And right. So that was one where it felt sort of thematically similar. And the other 25% are ones where I'm, where maybe like a specific word has been used that where like I feel like that word or something like that, like it would be fun to find a Shakespearean reference where Shakespeare also sort of used that word or talked about that word. And that's where whereas the first group of references I mentioned, those are sort of coming out of my own memory of Shakespeare. The second group is there's a reference online called Open Source Shakespeare, which I just love and will plug anytime and because it's basically like a, you know, it's a reference site for Shakespeare, so you can go and you can type whatever word you want to in the search bar and it will show you all the times that Shakespeare ever used that word.
Wow.
It will like show you concordance.
Yes, and it shows you the context of the line around it and that kind of thing, and then you can drill down and see where that is within the broader scene, within the play and that kind of stuff. So it's super useful. And sometimes I use it for things like, sometimes I want to use a word and I wonder if Shakespeare ever used this word. I wonder if it would be an appropriate word to use, which doesn't always, mm-hmm. I mean, if I find out that Shakespeare didn't use it, that doesn't necessarily stop me, but sometimes I let it guide me. So yeah. So that's how some of the other references work.
Well, see, I think that's perfect awesome. Too, because that, my mind's been going ever since I've been reading the A New Hope, thinking, oh man, there's so many things I could tie in here. And I think with all these references, since it is seventh grade, a lot of the students, they've not read Shakespeare yet. So this is kind of a way to kind of help them dip their toes into that as well. I'm like, okay, it's a fun book. It's got a lot of course, it's telling the story of Star Wars, which, believe it or not, a lot of students haven't seen Star Wars yet, so I'll have to remedy that too this year. But I think this is perfect for introducing so much Shakespeare and so much more elements of drama here. And I guess to tie it into a question, do you know of a lot of schools that use your material?
Yeah, I've talked with and worked with a bunch of different schools and teachers who use the books, which is just, I mean, that is the biggest honor for me as an author. You know, I always say that, like, my primary reason for writing these books was just for them to be fun and something that people enjoy. But my secondary reason right after that is, you know, that is the hope that these might be, just like you said, you know, sort of bridges into Shakespeare for students. Because I recognize how lucky I was and kind of how unusual I was in being somebody who sort of took to Shakespeare so naturally and that sort of thing. And that's not the story for most kids. And so mm-hmm. to be able to help with that, you know, and help facilitate, hopefully, kids' interest in Shakespeare is definitely something that I wanted to do. And so, yeah, I've worked with different teachers and different classes and schools, visited schools, and I've Skyped with classrooms and stuff like that. And with a lot of teachers who are using it just the way you described, you know, that, like, kids will read some of this, and it's certainly not as hard as Shakespeare, but you are getting a lot of the conventions. You're getting mm-hmm. iambic pentameter and some of the literary devices and some direct references from Shakespeare. So that hopefully then when you jump into real Shakespeare, it's not quite as big of a leap.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, anytime I would mention Shakespeare, the kids would just immediately cringe. Of course, they never read anything from him. They're like, ah, oh, Shakespeare, ah.
Right,
so
right.
This is a perfect way to kind of ease them into it.
I mean, I think it's so interesting, right? I think we have this cultural fear about Shakespeare because mm-hmm. we just sort of, you know, kids just sort of assume that it's going to be difficult and that they're not going to understand it.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and then they immediately kind of shut down before we even try to read anything.
Right.
And I'll have to remember that Skype call conversation that you've had with some teachers before, so... Maybe I can use you again one day.
Yeah, just let me know.
Awesome.
Great.
That's good to know.
So I also had the privilege of getting to read the From a Certain Point of View 40th Anniversary book, and I didn't know until I'd picked it up that you had actually contributed to that too. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened, whether or not it was something you volunteered to do or were you asked to do it, and why you picked the story or the soliloquy from Palpatine that you did?
Yeah, so that one was just sort of a random thing that dropped in my lap. I got an email one day from Elizabeth Schaefer, who was an editor at Random House, and she was the one putting together this collection. And they were sort of near the end of their process of finding authors and that sort of thing. And so they asked me to do it, and I only had like a couple of weeks, I think, turnaround time. It was a pretty quick turnaround. And they sort of had a list of, you know, they told me a little bit about some of what the other ones that were going to be in the book were. And then they gave me a list of characters that, you know, that would be possible ideas that I could do. And at the same time, they were like, we'd love it to be Palpatine, you know, they sort of, you know, thought that would be a cool one. And the only other one, I mean, the other one on their list that I thought would be potentially interesting was Chewbacca. I don't remember which moment in the movie it was for Chewbacca, but basically Chewbacca reacting to something that was going on. But I was happy to do Palpatine too. I mean, like I said earlier, I love a good villain. And so I took that on and, you know, just tried to imagine what it would be like for Palpatine to hear about Darth Vader killing Obi-Wan and what the different sort of things he'd be thinking about and worrying about would be there. And yeah, so it was it's really fun to be part of that collection and to be among such an amazing group of authors there. And so I'm still sort of hoping that I'll get a phone call about that they'll be doing one for Empire, and that I'll get a similar email coming through. We'll see.
Oh, that'd be cool.
That'd be fantastic. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Like, I've enjoyed the whole book, but when I realized that you had contributed, and I've been reading the Shakespeare and Star Wars books for a while now, I was like, oh man, I wonder what he did. Because even though this is a very recent read for me, it's been out years and I haven't had the chance to read it, I finally sat down and I'm like, this was great. You know, I'd never thought about it. I'm like, who would have thought to put Palpatine into the story of the original Star Wars? I mean, obviously he would be aware of what was going on, but who would have thought that, you know, it would be such a necessary thing now to go, well, that makes sense. That's kind of what would go through his head. It would have ties back to Revenge of the Sith and things like that. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and that's part of
a really neat contribution.
I think that's part of the genius of the overall concept of that book, which I had nothing to do with, you know, in terms of like whoever came up with the idea for the book. But like, it is such a fun idea to think like, hey, there are so many people in the Star Wars galaxy. What might people who weren't directly in the movie be thinking about what's going on, or people you sort of see randomly in the corner, you know, like what might they think? And yeah, so it's a really great idea for a book.
You mentioned that you picked up reading as a hobby pretty much after college. What do you like to read? Do you like to read Star Wars books? Are there other genres that are more your preference?
I read a ton of fiction. When I first started writing these books, I used to get put, sometimes still do get put on like science fiction panels at various places. And that was, I always felt like a little bit of an imposter because I had not read a lot of science fiction. So something like 5 years ago, I put out on Facebook, I asked all my friends like, hey, if I were trying to like familiarize myself with sci-fi, what should I be reading? You know? And so I got all kinds of answers, and I've basically been making my way through that reading list ever since. So I've now finally like read a lot of the classic sci-fi stuff and more modern sci-fi. But I also just love, I mean, anything that's good fiction, I'm interested in reading. There's a writer named Tana French who is she writes books based in Ireland, and they're not quite murder mysteries. They sort of have to do with this police squad in Ireland, but she writes so well. Her character development is just so amazing. I've been reading through the last few years. I've been reading through every one of Stephen King's books at the rate of about one a month. So that's been sort of a fun project. I think I'll finally catch up to him next year.
Wow.
So,
what'd you think of, while we're on him, what'd you think about the Dark Tower series?
I would say I loved it. There are parts of it I think that, I mean, and if it's a 7-book series, right? And so like there,
right.
So it's inevitable that there are parts of it that like are going to be a little more of a slog than other parts. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoyed it, and the way it ended kind of blew me away. I was like, wow, that was really masterfully done.
It was. Yeah. That was kind of mind blowing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of, I had that moment, you know, like I was reading it on I think I was reading it on a Sunday morning, like right before I went to church. And I was like I was just sitting there thinking about it through the whole service.
I remember reading that 7th book and going, what?
Yeah.
Part of me was angry and part of me was just impressed. I was,
totally.
It was very hard to, I can understand that. Sorry, that was a completely unrelated question.
No, that's
anytime I hear Stephen King, that series pops in my head because that's kind of iconic for him, for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, so like, I really will just read just about anything, you know. I'm happy to read any kind of nonfiction on just about any topic as long as it's interestingly written, right? Anytime you're reading about something that is somebody else's passion, you can feel that passion coming through.
Yeah.
That I always enjoy too.
You know, speaking of reading here, you know, I kind of heard it in one of your previous answers, but what advice would you give to aspiring young writers? And like you said, reading is a big inspiration for you to write, but is there any other advice you would give to people who want to write for a living?
I mean, I think I would say if you're working on something, if you're writing something, just make sure that it's life-giving to you and that you're enjoying it, that you're having a good time, because I think that if you're working on something and it feels like homework, you're not going to do your best writing, probably. You know, so so whatever it is that you feel drawn to write about, you know, write about that. And if nothing else, you are sort of honing your writing skills, and you're getting good practice at writing. And I think, I mean, yes, like I said earlier, you know, I do think that you have to read a lot to be a good writer. And I think that part of that is also, I mean, it's reading a lot, and it's noticing how people are using language and what people are doing with language, and that sort of thing. And I think that you can really get a sense of sort of the possibilities of writing when you spend time reading a lot of different really good writers. There's a guy I love who's, his name is Brian Doyle, and he's an author from Portland, actually, and he just died a couple of years ago at the age of like 51 of brain cancer. And and unfortunately I discovered him just only right before he died, but now I've been like literally I've bought like every single book he's ever written now, and I'm reading through them. But he does these like these long sentences almost to the point of ridiculousness, you know, but he does it so well, and it's so beautiful, and so like that, to me, that's just another like sort of way in which something has been opened up to me. I'm like, wow, this, you know, this is another way of doing this writing thing. And it really works well, and it's compelling to read. And so, obviously I think reading is an important part of writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that seems to be the thing that my students want to do the least. I'm a reading teacher. That's like kind of my area. And I'm just glad that you brought that up, because I have a lot of students that say they want to write more, and they do have a raw talent for writing. But, you know, I've always encouraged, you know, to read more, to kind of see what other folks do. And just like you said, how they use language and the skills that you see, you know, and you, it's not like you're literally taking notes as you're reading, but it's something you will notice when you read.
Yeah.
And it can definitely only help you improve. So yep. I'm so glad you brought that up.
It's a similar trait in, I would say, all the arts, but definitely music, since that's my preference. A lot of times they argue the same. If you're looking at writing music, one of the things you should seriously consider is listening to different kinds of music to find what parts of each you would like to incorporate into your own compositions, which makes a unique voice for you.
Yep.
And I think that's very similar in the writing element as well. You know, the more you've read, the more you're able to kind of take all of those other voices and create your own unique contributions.
Yeah, that's totally true about music too, right? If you only ever listen to Mozart, you know, and then you sit down and write music, you're going to write music that sounds something like Mozart, exactly. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
I was a music
major. Well, he's a great composer. There's a lot of stuff out there. Really?
Yeah. Back in the day. So, I can go down this nerd road with you too.
So, what was your primary instrument?
Well, so I'm a singer, and I also write music. Major That's itself awesome. Was basically theory and history, so it was not a performance major.
Still, that's fantastic. I teach 5th grade through 12th grade band, and I also teach high school chorus. And actually, I used some of the prologue for the Verily a New Hope, and I do a composition project with my students where I let them choose poetry and try to adapt music to the text, because I teach text painting. To them, and just say, all right, you know, we look at different choral works that obviously incorporate it so they can understand the concept, and then I say, okay, pick a poem, and I give them about 3 or 4 options so that I'm not, you know, Googling 15 different poems every semester.
Right.
And just say, pick a poem and kind of do it line by line, and how would you want to musically represent this? And a couple of them actually went with the Shakespeare Star Wars prologue, just because I knew it was Star Wars.
Oh, that's
fun. Thought it would be really cool to try to incorporate it. I was like, that's awesome. You know, obviously, I'm excited about it, because I'm able to incorporate Star Wars and music at the same time, and, you know,
yeah,
kind of go
totally.
With it. So
well,
we had a lot of fun with it this year.
As a person whose life was completely changed by being in high school choirs in a good way, and as a person who now has a son who is deeply involved in band, thank you for all you do.
Well, thank you.
That's awesome.
Thank you. So this is I don't know if you can answer this question or not yet, but since the title has already been announced for episode 9, I was wondering if you had an idea of how you were going to adapt that title for your adaptation of it.
And the honest answer is I don't know yet. I mean, there are ideas that are being thrown around with me and my editor, but we don't have anything definitive yet. So I always, you know, I always want to try to do something a little bit different, you know, with these, because like it's totally fine, but like, you know, we did the Force Doth Awaken, which felt a little too much to me like the Jedi Doth Return, but that was also like, you know, there were not a whole lot of options. So I would love to try to do something a little bit different with this one. I am somewhat interested in, and I don't know what my editor think. I don't know what Lucasfilm will think, but I'm kind of interested in working in the phrase "all's well that ends well," you know, this title somehow, but we'll see. Yeah. I don't actually know yet.
Cool. I also saw that you had an adaptation of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens into a Shakespearean style. That's awesome. That's one of my favorite books. I read it about every Christmas just because I love the story so much, and even the story behind the writing of it in terms of Dickens' history. Are there any others that you would like to adapt into Shakespearean style or have plans to do? Any other franchises or stories that just kind of you think would fit really well, like Star Wars did, to the Shakespearean design?
So this past year, Quirk Books has worked with me, and we've launched what we're calling this Pop Shakespeare series. And so in April, we had actually Mean Girls and Back to the Future both come out as Shakespearean adaptations.
It's all awesome.
So
I've got to go find Back to the Future.
Yeah. So those will continue next year. We'll be doing some other movies that I can't talk about right now. But in terms of ones that I'd like to do, I mean, like Princess Bride is kind of on my wish list of one I'd like to do. I think it'd be really fun to incorporate. You know, it'd be an adaptation of the movie, but you would incorporate a lot of the backstory that's in the book into that through soliloquies and things like that. So that's one that's been on my mind for a few years now. Who knows if it will actually come to fruition or not. And in terms of,
I would love that.
Yeah. And in terms of other public domain or near public domain things, I mean, the other one that I sort of have had on my mind that would probably be an adaptation for like 10 people in the world who would enjoy it. But like, I've kind of thought it would be fun to combine The Tempest with Lord of the Flies, where like these boys are arriving on this island, and it's actually, you know, Caliban and Ariel who are sort of creating a lot of the mischief that's going around with the boys and that sort of thing. And I don't know. It's sort of this weird idea. It's not even a movie mashup. It's just a literary one. But Lord of the Flies was another one that I think I first had to read it in like sixth grade and just fell in love with it. So anyway, so we'll see.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's awesome. And this is a completely fanboy question I'm going to ask you, but I am a diehard Turtles fan, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Would you ever consider adapting something like that in the near future?
I mean, that's the sort of thing. I will say that the direction that some of these, like, I never thought I'd do Mean Girls, right? Like Mean Girls was never kind of on my radar to do, and Quirk Books brought it to me as an idea and thought it would be a good idea. And so we did it, and it's been great, and I've loved it. And so I would put Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in that category, right, of like, I'm willing to do just about anything.
So you're telling me there's a chance.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
That's fantastic. Have you ever considered doing the new spinoffs that they're doing with Star Wars in terms of like Rogue One or the Solo movie or anything like that?
I mean, I would love to. It's really Lucasfilm's call, and they decided sometime around when Rogue One was out or coming out, they decided that it made more sense for me just to do the primary episode.
The saga.
Yeah. So I have not done those, and I doubt I will at this point, but, you know, it's still possible, I suppose. But I think it's not likely.
Well, you said you write academic books as well. So are there any writing projects right now that you want to tell us about and, you know, let our listeners kind of look more deeply into getting some of your works? I know you mentioned the Mean Girls and the Back to the Future books that you've recently published, but is there anything else that you'd like to share with us?
I never got a chance to write or publish an academic book, and at this point probably won't. But I do have another book coming out in October 1st. It is a little bit of a different thing for me, and it's kind of not a little bit different also. You'll understand what I mean in a second. It is called Mech Trump, so it's a little bit of a political book, but that is coming out in October.
Oh, awesome.
Okay, awesome. Speaking of October, just popped in my head. We do themes for this podcast that kind of cycle us through the seasons. Mm-hmm. So right now we're in what we call a Summer of Stormtroopers series, where we try to focus on comics or books that specifically kind of deal with stormtroopers. And then we're doing, at the recommendation of one of our listeners, a fall focused on like horror. And kind of doing zombies and some of the classic horror characters that were adapted into some Star Wars comics. Have you considered like the classic Frankenstein by Mary Shelley or Bram Stoker's Dracula in like a Shakespearean style? That would be really interesting, I think.
That would be really fun. And I would say I've been getting into horror more and more the last like 3 or 4 years. And I have not read some of those, you know, I haven't read Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I haven't read Bram Stoker's Dracula. So I should read those classics, and it would be fun to adapt one. I have been thinking recently that it would be kind of fun to adapt a horror something or other. So that's a good idea to take some of those that are in the public domain.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan, mm-hmm. so I'll keep an eye out. If you release anything like that, rest assured, I'll buy it.
All right, well, there's two. All right, good.
Rob, do you have anything else?
Yeah, I guess it's just kind of more of a philosophical question, but what does the Star Wars franchise, you know, mean to you on a personal level and your involvement in it?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I feel the same way about Shakespeare, right? When I was growing up, I never, you know, I had no idea until I was 35, which is when this idea first came about for me. No idea that these things were going to be part of my life in the way that they are now. And so I just have a lot of gratitude about the Star Wars franchise overall and the fact that it exists. And you know, and frankly, I did not know before I became a Star Wars author. I mean, I was a fan of the movies, obviously, and I knew that there was a sort of big world in the books, but I had never dipped my toes in that world. And I didn't really understand how big the Star Wars universe was until I became a Star Wars author and you know, started going to conventions and things like that, you know, and so I just have a lot of gratitude for what Star Wars is and for how large it's grown. You know, I think it's sort of our modern mythology, right?
Yeah.
Like, in the same way that, you know, the Greeks had their mythology and that kind of stuff. Like, this is the story that, like, and certainly there are plenty of people out there who have never seen Star Wars, but it's also amazing the number of people who have, right? And you can go to any country in the world and you can see people walking around in, you know, in Star Wars t-shirts and stuff like that. And I got invited a few years ago to a literary festival in Malaysia, and I met members of the Star Wars fan club in Malaysia, right?
Wow.
And like,
wow.
And of course that makes sense, right? Like it's a movie and of course it goes around the world and everyone knows it, but like, you know, it's just kind of amazing to go that far from home and like find people who are geeking out on the same thing that I've been geeking out on forever. So I just kind of, I love that aspect of Star Wars, and you know, and I guess I have a little bit of a wish that like all of the sort of people who have been upset around The Last Jedi, like to me, I just wish a little bit that, that people could enjoy this lovely thing that we have in our lives
yeah.
a little more and not feel like it has to be exactly the way that you want it to be or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, that's my sort of scattered thoughts about.
I love it.
All.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. The polarity that The Last Jedi has caused is definitely, I think, still fresh on everybody's minds, even though it's been almost a couple of years now. And it's, for lack of a better word, just unfortunate that we're finding something so wonderful that is the Star Wars franchise, and we're finding ways to argue about it when really we should, like you said, be celebrating the fact that we still mm-hmm. have
right.
it.
Right.
Still relevant, yeah.
10 years ago, Star Wars was dying because there wasn't there wasn't any chance really that we knew of coming out with new movies or anything like that. And now we're getting, you know, the possibility to be able to see a lot more Star Wars in our future, and instead of enjoying and relishing in that, we're arguing about
right.
it.
Right. Yeah, totally.
It seems like we're kind of missing the point.
Yep, I agree.
So, well, Ian, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for meeting with us and recording with us. This was an honor and a pleasure for both of us to kind of get to meet the man behind the books. And we certainly hope our listeners will enjoy this as much as we have, and I'm sure they will, five or six that we have.
well, thank you, guys. I really appreciate you having me on.
Yes, I hope to do this again someday.
All right, let me know.
Especially for Rob with his teaching. I'm trying to help him convince his school board.
Oh, I already have my text written out to my boss. We're using this.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We really appreciate it.
Have a good day, guys.
You too, Ian. Thank you very much.
You too. Right, thanks.
Bye.
Bye. Wow.
Yeah, what a nice guy, huh?
Yeah, well, that was great. And that was, I mean, that was perfect.
Yeah, well, yeah, we got right in and out.
I mean, we were able to get all the questions we had.
That was a fun one. He seemed so down to earth.
Yeah, he was a lot of fun. I did not know that he was a chorus
kid.
Not either. That he had a kid in band. I mean, like, this guy's like a kindred spirit.
Yeah, no kidding. And I honestly think
he fits both of us.
Exactly.
Perfectly.
I was like, the rapport that we had with him, like, I think he could come on. He would come on our show in a heartbeat again.
Yeah, I kind of want to maybe email him after he finally does release the last one, and just kind of talk about what it was like to conclude the saga in Shakespearean style and kind of things like that. Just to kind of, I mean, I know it would probably be a shorter interview just because we would have less about the writing process and stuff like that to talk about.
Yeah.
But it would be really cool to just kind of get him to be like, now that the last one of the Skywalker saga has been released in Shakespearean form.
Yeah.
How you feel?
I mean, you've covered them all.
Dude. Yeah. And I mean, and the possibility he's on board if they ever do a 40th anniversary from a certain point of view of The Empire Strikes Back, that would be awesome. I'm telling you, you got to go read that. I checked it out from the library. That's the only.
I may buy these. No joke. I may buy these because these are worth it. I think to invest in. You can teach them.
Well, I picked up mine at used bookstore.
Yeah, that's probably the way to go.
Every single copy I've gotten has been at a used bookstore of these Shakespeare Star Wars books, and I'm gonna keep collecting them. I mean, you know, they're like $5 to $8 at a used bookstore. I have no problem.
Man, that's awesome.
You know, and they're good. And I'm so excited that you might be able to incorporate it in your classroom.
Dude, seriously, I wasn't even kidding.
You got to keep me updated. I want to know if your principal is like, I'm on board.
I wasn't even kidding because yesterday we had talked about one of my books that I had ordered hasn't come in yet. So she may have to process another book order anyway. And she said she asked me if I need anything else. So I'm going to seriously pitch this idea to her today. I'm going to text her a picture and let her know it's all family friendly. And this is perfect for us because – Like he said, it's a bridge into Shakespeare, but it's also fun, and it's Star Wars. And for me personally, I could have so much fun with this. Now, the problem is, I might be super excited about this. Will the kids be super excited about this? That's why I'm going to try to...
See, I don't know if they would be at first, but I think it would be something where we're going to be reading a Shakespearean adaptation instead of Shakespeare straight on, they're going to be more inclined to do it. Because they know they're not reading legitimate, you know, William Shakespeare. And then you sit there and you say, oh, by the way, it's Star Wars. They know you have an interest in Star Wars. They know you have a passion for it. So
I think your passion is going to
kind of seep into it.
That's true. I hope so.
And now I'm going to keep an eye out for a William Shakespeare's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And when that happens, I'm going to call it. Rob Luther called that. August 3rd, 2019, Rob Luther gave him the idea.
I'll tell you. It's documented. Yeah.
It's documented. It's in the blooper reel of our episode today.
Oh, gosh. Wait, could you imagine? And I could actually see it really working well. I really could. I mean, you've got the Renaissance painters. You got a little bit of – oh, man. I think it could somehow work.
I think it would be fantastic. I really hope he does the horror characters.
Yeah.
Mary Shelley's Frankenstein has got to be one of the best tragedies of that particular era of stories, and to see that adapted into a Shakespearean play in its real, like the real story, not the monster mash movie stories kind of thing, even though those are okay, but the actual, I don't think there's ever been a movie adaptation that really gets the same emotional charge that the book did.
Yeah.
As far as Mary Shelley, and I'll admit, I didn't make it through Bram Stoker's Dracula. I'm going to have to do it again.
It's a hard read. I definitely try it again.
His writing style is really difficult, but with the Kevin Scott IDW Star Wars adaptations of classic monster characters into Star Wars, I'm having more reason to go back and read them. So he did. I know I've told Landon this, but I don't think I told you. Kevin Scott did. It's a trade paperback. It's called Star Wars Adventures. And, I mean, it's a series of comics that have been out for a few years, and he's one of the writers for them. But he did a trade paperback or a miniseries called Tales from Vader's Castle. And what he did is he adapted classic horror stories into Star Wars side stories. Uh-huh. So you're focusing on, like, two kids that are lost in space trying to find their parents, which is his own story. You know, it's kind of his ongoing novel series, junior novelization series for middle school age kids called The Adventures in Wild Space. And the tales from Wild Space focus on these two kids kind of telling each other stories. Have you ever heard about this one? What about this one? And they end up being stories about the classic Star Wars characters. Well, in this particular case, the Tales from Vader's Castle, it's all horror stories. And in the original, the ones that we're going to be reviewing for The Fall of Horror, one of them is Bram Stoker's Dracula, adapted about Count Dooku.
Oh, wow.
Because Christopher Lee, who plays
Count
Dooku,
was also Dracula
also
in the 60s.
Played Dracula. Yeah. So Kevin Scott was like, I had to do that. You know, I was going to do something else. And then I made that connection. I was like, nope, that has to be a reality. So he did that plus three other horror stories that were based on, you know, one of them is about Hera and Kanan from Star Wars Rebels. One of them, I think, is a Han and Chewie one, and then I don't remember what the fourth one is. But they're each, you know, different stories, but they're horror stories kind of adapted into comic book form. And then he's doing a second volume this October that he's going to be releasing.
Wow.
They announced it at the San Diego Comic-Con, and he's going to be doing, I think, Grand Moff Tarkin, Darth Vader, Jabba the Hutt, Asajj Ventress, and somebody else.
Ooh, this sounds really good. Are they on trade paperback now, the collections? Or?
The original one, the original one is. The other ones haven't been released yet. They're going to be released each issue this October.
Oh, wow.
But the volume one came out a year ago, and the trade paperback is already out there. I saw it at Barnes & Noble and almost grabbed it, but it was like $13.
Yeah.
Went on Amazon, it's like $7.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
So... yeah, I'm going to be hitting up Amazon. But anyway, so I sent you and Landon a text a couple days ago. I got approval from Kevin Scott's publishers, the guy that wrote these horror stories.
Yeah, I didn't know who that was. Yeah.
So he also wrote for the From a Certain Point of View book, and he wrote it from the perspective of Ghost Obi-Wan.
Wow.
So, like, the moment when Obi-Wan Kenobi becomes a background character... because he gets slashed with the lightsaber by Darth Vader, you get his perspective of that moment as the ethereal ghost kind of floating in the background.
Very cool.
Which was a really... I mean, it was just a fascinating story. I would have never thought about
it that way. I need to get
that book. So I was... yeah, it's... I don't own it, but I've put that on my list too. I'm like, guys, I've got to have this book. It's because there's 40 authors in here. If I interview any of them, I can always go back and talk to them about that book too. You know... so anyway, I really appreciate you doing this with me. I know you're always, you know, strapped for time and stuff like that.
Oh, no, I appreciate you inviting me, man. That was a great one.
Yeah, man. I'm really glad to have you on anytime I can.
Yes, I feel the same way about you, man. I really appreciate it, and thanks for having me on. And, dude, really excited to
thank you.
Talk about the book in our classroom, hopefully one day. And excited to talk about
keep me updated. I would like
to
know
let her know what she says.
Like, I think that would be awesome.
That would be amazing. But, but buddy, I'll holler. I think Lear's crying, so I'll hop off here. But, man, I appreciate you. And I'll holler at you maybe next Saturday morning or something.
Yeah, I'll let you go. Thanks again,
Rob. All right,
Rob.
Man. You too, buddy. Have a good day. Until after I said hi. And good luck maybe to watch us go.
I will. You tell the family I said hi too.
I sure will, man.
Oh, yeah, we'll try.
See you, buddy.
We'll see you, bud. Bye. But I do have a kind of a selfish request.
Sure.
I usually try to incorporate a plug from some of the authors that we've interviewed as part of my introduction for the podcast.
Okay.
Just kind of saying, you know, I'm Ian Desher, and, you know, I'm the author of Shakespeare's Star Wars, and you are listening to Star Wars Ties, something like that, you know, just to kind of let them get a chance to go, oh, okay, cool, we get to hear somebody new. So I've got the recorder running,
great.
So however you wish, that would be great.
This is Ian Desher, the author of the William Shakespeare Star Wars series, and you are listening to Star Wars Ties.
Awesome. That's all fantastic. Downhill from here. It
gives us more street cred. Yeah, everything after this is, you know, debatable, but that's great. Thank you.
Thank right, you no so problem. Much. Yeah, it's almost like we know what we're doing.
Maybe. We might have an idea. Sorry, I gotta blow my nose. I've been trying so hard to do it like off screen, and usually I don't use the camera, but when we did Alan Dean Foster, he was like, I can't see you. So I was like, I want to be prepared in case he has to see me, you know. I need to do an introduction because we never did one.
Oh, no, we just kind of jumped into it, didn't we?
So we just kind of jumped in, and that's fine, but I need to do one real fast. I'm trying to think when I'm going to release this. My goal is to release it after we're done. Like, this is going to be my transition from Summer of Stormtroopers into Fall of Horror.
Mm-hmm.
So my intention is to release this after, let's see, the one I just recorded with Lynn was 35. This would be episode, like, 39, but I don't think I'm going to do that. Because if I release it earlier than that, that would be bad. I'm like, this is episode 39, when really it's episode 32.
They're like, ah, those are lost episodes, so, those other ones.
Yeah, well, and no, they're not. But I try to record so far in advance that as I edit, you know, I can get the stuff released on time.
Yeah, smart man. That's the way to do it.
So, and I mean, it's been really handy this summer because I've gotten more material out this summer, I think, than I've ever gotten.
Wow.
This summer alone has released probably almost 10 episodes.
That's great, man. I'm glad you're pumping some content out there. That's awesome.
Well, I mean, it's because I spent so much time banking them and recording them and then editing and then editing and then editing and then scheduling them to be released every 2 weeks. You know, that puts me further ahead every time. It's like, oh, there's another 2 weeks I have. Yep, there's another 2 weeks I have. So, you know, Landon gets sick or Lola gets sick, which has happened a couple times, or, you know, you and I can't work out something. Then it's just like, it's no big deal. I've still got like a month before I have to release anything. So, you know.
Sweet.
Before I have to have anything edited. So it's
yeah,
kind of handy.
Yeah.
But anyway, let me go ahead and do that introduction and then we'll you and I will close out so I can let you get to your
that
lady.
Sounds good, buddy.
I can help mine close
yes,
out.
Good thinking.
Hi, Mr. All right, I'm going to have to say this. I always do this. How do I pronounce your last name? I'm sorry.
It's Desher, but you should just call me Ian.
Ian? Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
And hey, how about that nutty Star Wars bar? Can you forget all the creatures in there? And hey, Darth Vader in that black and evil mask. Did he scare you as much as he scared me? Ah! Star Wars! Those here in Star Wars! My seventh winner up here! Star Wars!
Yeah,